The date is January 29th, 1992. The time is 1:27. Today we are going to interview Mrs. Eileen Naniga. Mrs. Naniga is a resident of the Cooperative Subdivision. Mrs. Naniga, please state your name and present address for this taped interview.
My name is Eileen Naniga. My nickname is Ella. A lot of people here know me by Ella. And my address is 31255 Tawas.
Please give us the name of your husband and any children you may have had.
My husband is deceased now. His name was Earl. And I had three sons, David, Nathan, and Hugh. They all attended the Lamphere School District all the way through and saw all the new schools being built. When we first moved here, the only school was the one on where Farmer Jack's is now.
Okay, that was on the north side of 13 and the east side of John R.
Yes.
Okay.
Uh-huh. And
that was Lamphere Elementary.
That was Lamphere Elementary. And then they had to go to Madison District to go to high school.
Oh, you're kidding. I didn't realize that.
But by
that.
The time David was ready to go to high school, they had built a brand new one.
How did they get down to Madison High School? Did they walked probably, right?
I'm not sure.
Not a bus.
I didn't experience
that. Oh, okay. Okay. You were selected as an interviewee because of your longtime residency in Madison Heights. How long have you lived here?
Well, we were my husband and I married in 41, and just before we got married, we decided that we wanted to be members of the co-op.
Okay.
And
now you were selected because of your involvement with the cooperative movement. Now, what do you remember about the original formation of the co-op?
There were I think you could call it two nucleus groups.
Okay.
Fred Thornthwaite was the co-op educator.
Okay.
And he had a co-op house going where both young men and women resided. And
Was in Detroit?
Yeah.
Okay.
And they were all single people, and the girls were on one floor and the fellas on the other, but they did all the household things together, you know, assigned duties and so on. And
did you and Earl live there?
No, Earl lived there.
Okay.
And he enjoyed living there.
Mm-hmm.
They had a good fellowship and everything went smoothly. And at the same time, there was a group living in several families of the original group that were living in the Parkside housing project. And they became good friends, and they were all factory workers and had a 3-month layoff in the summertime.
Okay.
And they were anxious to get into their own homes.
Parkside was it's a big project,
it's
right?
It's a big government project.
It was like Brewster Project or whatever we have today.
Yeah.
Okay.
At that time it was brand new, though. It was very nice.
Okay.
And so anyway, Fred Thornthwaite organized a few people, and we met in the basement of the Parkside Project.
Okay.
And then they considered where they might buy some property to collectively,
mm-hmm.
and that they would they drafted bylaws then,
mm-hmm.
and they drew up their charter. I think it's called.
Mm-hmm.
And
did you have money? Did you all have a small amount of money?
Everyone was working, so they just put in what they could and built up their own equity.
I see.
And then the expenses, of course, we shared collectively.
Okay. Now, when they actually bought the piece of land, did they have money from all of you, or was there someone that kind of bankrolled the project or bought the land?
Well, the land, believe it or not, was selling for $100 an acre.
Okay.
And we bought 120 acres. And who was bankrolling it? I don't know. I wasn't the bookkeeper at that time.
Okay.
I wasn't bookkeeper until a while after the war.
Okay. $100 an acre, though, it wasn't too bad to try to come up with $100.
True enough. Yeah. And if you were going to build a home, you know, you had to start collecting somehow. And so it wasn't long before they had a clear deed on the property.
Okay.
And then they decided they wanted to collect tools together so that there wouldn't be such a duplicate purchase of tools for everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And on the property, there was an old farmhouse and two big barns. The farmhouse had been abandoned for a long time, and the barns were deteriorating. But the one barn was good enough to store tools in. And so they started to buy a tractor and shovels and
necessity. That came in really handy for your purposes, the old
yeah.
one. Okay.
And then...
All of this was bought together, too, wasn't it? It was a
yes,
co-op?
Yes, it was.
Okay.
They were incorporated at the time the purchase was made.
Okay.
And then someone started to steal the tools out of the barn, so they realized they needed somebody living on the premises. And Fred and Faith Hiller had just recently married, and they sectioned off, oh, it was just two small rooms, a little porch.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no water, no toilet. So the first necessity, of course, was an outhouse
okay.
for the purposes of the total membership.
Mm-hmm.
And then the men got together and dug a well.
Okay.
The first well they dug had gas, and so they utilized that for the farmhouse first, and then the second well they found water.
Did they use anyone to find the spot, or did they just do it themselves?
Oh, I suppose they had their own little devices. I don't know.
Okay.
You know, they probably had ideas among them, but mm-hmm. I wasn't in on that process.
Okay.
And so then the water was hooked up. Then they when they got an indoor toilet, then they had to put in a septic field for the farmhouse.
Okay. They really put a lot of work in this building.
Well, they had to make it livable.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they did a minimum, and it always was considered a temporary kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I particularly remember the use of the mattress boxes, you know. As new wallboard because the plaster was so...
to cover the holes in the wall.
Falling down,
mm-hmm.
and the wasps were coming in. it was pretty bizarre.
Mm-hmm.
But it didn't take too much work, you know.
Did you and your husband move there?
Yeah, we were the fourth family to move in that building. Everybody had a little efficiency apartment.
Okay.
And there were three of them downstairs, and Earl and I took two... big bedrooms upstairs. They were so bright, and I was a city gal all my life, but I really loved it.
This was a change for you, wasn't it?
Oh, it was a radical change, and my parents were kind of, you know, nervous about my marriage to Earl and the primitive conditions I was going into, you know.
Where did your parents live? Were they in Detroit?
Yeah.
Okay.
And we were born in Norway, but... from the age of four, I lived in Detroit.
Okay.
And
you stayed in there how long?
Well, I could have stayed longer, I guess, but the war came up.
Okay.
And in the process of living there, we didn't have water upstairs yet. And I remember so clearly we improvised everything, you know. Just orange crates were our cupboards, and just the cheapest kind of sink to work in, you know, and one metal cupboard that was secure from any kind of mice that might come into the house, you know, because we were out in the country and field mice, you know, in the fall they would want to come in,
mm-hmm.
But that worked out fine, and then Earl had to carry. Earl got a brand new garbage can. Expense number one. And he put a spigot on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And then he carried the water up
For your water.
For our water supply. And we had an oil stove upstairs, and so that had to be, it had a tank behind it, so that had to be carried up too.
Now, while you were living there, they were planning on doing something with the land?
Yeah.
Or were they working on the land
at all?
There
was no road work or anything.
Oh, there wasn't anything. It was just, okay.
And it had just been farmland.
Okay.
And there was some road work that had started when one of the men, Mr. Civic, started to build his house.
He was one of the group?
Yeah.
Okay.
And the Van Hellas built a little garage-type home.
Okay.
And that was convenient to the road. But Mr. Civics had to go around farther on what was going to be called Co-op Circle.
Okay.
And when Frank Lloyd Wright came on the scene, Mr. Civic dropped out his membership because he'd already formulated the house he wanted and started on the footings and he wasn't about to shift gears.
Okay, before we go any farther, can you give me the names of some of the original families?
The ones that lived in the Parkside were the Brzezinskis, Browns, and Novaks.
Okay.
I don't know if there were others. I was new to the group.
Just the ones that you can remember.
And some of the earlier ones, the Meekums, I don't know if they were at the charter members. The Valentines were early members. Hillers. Hillers were one of the...
right from the beginning.
In fact, Fred Hiller's mother wanted to have 5 acres at the time, and she dropped out when she couldn't have 5 acres in Independence. She'd been reading that book, 5 acres in Independence. A lot of them wanted kind of a small little farm unit of their own, you know. And that, by the way, caused a furor in the group when Wright came. He planted it for just 1 acre, you know. Some of them were an acre and a half.
Okay, now let's get on to Wright. You mentioned Wright. Now, how did he get involved in the project?
One of our members, Mr. Roth, lived in the farmhouse, and he was... had constructed a cube formation in which he tamped the earth right from our grounds. And you've maybe heard of Pizet houses.
Yes.
Well, they use straw with that. But this was just earth. But apparently it was the right texture to form these blocks properly.
Almost like adobe bricks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he wanted to build an inexpensive house, and so he was experimenting with it. Well, Frank Lloyd Wright was visiting a home that he had designed that's on, it was the Affleck House.
Okay.
And it's on Woodward. I believe it's in Bloomfield Hills.
Okay.
And when he saw this block... he took a strong interest in the co-op.
Someone took the block to him to show it to him.
Yes.
Okay.
He asked to see it, and I guess they had a laborious job getting it over to him, you know, because it was heavy. And apparently he was upstairs somewhere.
Mr. Novak helped carry that block up the stairs. He mentioned that in his interview.
Yeah. And whether he was at the co-op house at that time, I don't know, but... Anyway, he must have become acquainted with Fred Thornthwaite.
Okay.
And Fred maybe wanted to encourage him to have an input in our group.
Okay.
Although I don't know that for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, he did take an interest and he came out and talked to the people.
Actually out to your piece of property?
Yeah, I wasn't there at that time.
Okay.
But he had his flowing robes on and his...
black hat.
Black hat.
Right.
And his chapeau, you know.
Yes.
typical Wright style. And so it wasn't long before there was agreement that we should go ahead with Wright, because he convinced them that If we built houses like the Van Halles had built, we
like
would
a
soon
little
have,
garage house.
We'd soon have a built-in slum.
Okay.
And now the Van Halles lived in that house during the time that Wright's house was going up. It was right the next lot.
Mm-hmm.
So they bore the brunt, I'm sure, of a lot of the comings and goings of the membership and of the resident architects that came. By the way, the architects also lived in this farmhouse.
Oh, my goodness.
Up on the attic level, definitely attic rooms. Ours were lovely, big, airy, spacious rooms, but theirs were attic rooms, and they just constructed beds in there. And
these were Lloyd Wright's student architects.
Two of them were, and one was Hawkins Ferry.
Oh, okay. Seed Company. Ferry Seed Company.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he just wanted to volunteer his help out there. I don't think he was ever paid anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, and of course he wasn't, we weren't demanding anything of him either. He just wanted to be part of it.
Did you have to pay Wright?
Oh, yeah.
A retainer or whatever?
Well, he was paid, but I don't know exactly. I wasn't a bookkeeper at that time.
Okay.
And I was just glad the bills were paid.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone was quit contributing at the time.
You mm-hmm. You actually got to meet Wright, didn't you?
Yeah. After Earl was drafted, my car wasn't used that much, our car. And during the war, there was gas rationing. And it just happened that I was the one who had the gas rationing stamps on hand to make the trip to Wisconsin. And the on-site architects felt they had to consult with Wright. And so it was a real privilege to me. And Aaron Green was the one who drove. And Dorothy Sonquist accompanied me. And we were instructed to bring formals, and so we were kind of excited about the whole deal. And
you went to Taliesin?
Taliesin.
In Wisconsin.
Yeah.
Okay.
And en route, Aaron Green showed us several of the houses in the Chicago area that Wright had built, and also the Johnson Wax building.
Mm-hmm.
And I was so impressed with that building.
The columns.
Oh, the columns were beautiful. The brick was all beautifully waxed.
Mm-hmm.
And the elevator, you'd never before had I seen an elevator that was open. I think it was his idea, where the bronze bars glistened, you know, and
oh,
you could
goodness.
See out of it, you know.
There's a sidewalk or something that leads up to that building, too. Isn't there something special about the sidewalk?
Yeah, and he inserted little brick here and there, you know, in the sidewalk, so that you just gradually get the feeling of being in the building. As an office building, it interested me, too, because the windows were high, and above these tall files. And the files were colored differently for each department, and the furniture in each department had a separate color. So you knew there were separate departments, but there were no walls to separate them.
Oh, my goodness.
And these beautiful columns flared out at the top and made a diamond shape, you know, where the circles met. Just beautiful. Then we went to the home of the editor of the Chicago Tribune.
Mm-hmm.
And
that was another Wright house.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that home has a sunken living room, I remember, and a huge fireplace, very long. And
he liked big open spaces, didn't he?
Oh, everything's spacious with him. It really is. Space is so important. Even between houses, he doesn't think the shadow of one house should fall on another, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing he didn't construct spaciously was stairways. The stairway in that Affleck house, if you ever get over there, is very narrow. It goes down to the gully below, a basement level with a gully.
Mm-hmm.
And but that house is very worth seeing. And I love the feel of the brick on the inner wall, and then this spacious expanse of glass wall to the outside, you felt like you were outdoors all the time, you know. Mm-hmm. And then the simplicity of the furniture, I like that too.
Straight, clean lines.
Yeah.
Angles.
And then there's another feature in that house. When you come in the loggia, he had a construction in the floor that had glass that you could open up, and it would allow the cool air from the gully below to come up, and it was remarkable. But
this was in the Affleck house?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, getting back to the other house, there I noticed the kitchen was open to the living room, and the living room was definitely planned for guest entertainment and everything. And the sunken aspect of it had floors, steps, so that people, big groups of people, could sit, you know. And
it's almost like today's family rooms. Kitchens before were like separate rooms.
Yeah, family rooms were not at all common in mm-hmm. that time. That was the early 40s.
Okay.
50 years ago.
Sure.
And also with Wright, I became of his use of the cantilever, you know, a structural steel so that they could cantilever over spaces. And the Falling Waters house is a good example of that. Beautiful, beautiful structure. And he designed the overhanging eaves so that the winter sun would come in, but the summer sun would be shaded. So before that, the eaves were, you know, were just all eave troughs on the outside
sure.
of the house.
Sure.
And so overhanging eaves, I think, were his idea. And and then, of course, picture windows were coming in, but he used it much more extensively. And then that kitchen designed so that the woman is free, so it's open to the living area.
So she's not cut off while she's
so
cooking.
She can watch her yeah. children and be part of the family, and mm-hmm. not so cut off.
He was big on the family, too, wasn't he?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And he believed in the individual needs of each family, mm-hmm. and the home should be constructed for their needs and their interests. And I think the word is integrity. The integrity of the house should be
mm-hmm. sure.
compatible with the person. And the word functional was so in his vocabulary, too, that there was a simplicity, but everywhere you saw the need for that simplicity, you know. There mm-hmm. was a form and function. he was capable of bringing beauty to the simplest forms.
What was his academy like, his Taliesin?
Taliesin, when we arrived there, had a theater, and that's where we went first. Mm-hmm. And the supper was served on a tray that pulled down from the seat before it.
Functioning.
Like you have on airplanes now.
Mm-hmm.
And
comfortable?
Yes, very comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And we were shown a movie there. And the architect pointed out to me the design of the lights that were hanging before the movie was shown, you know, how the lights cast interesting shadows. Because of the way they were cut out and formed, the way the shading was formed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was interested in light and shadow as part of the beauty of things. And
plants? Did he use a lot of plants?
The place was surrounded by lots of woods and openness. And
how about the interior of the house?
The interior of his house, the living room. They first we went in for breakfast on Sunday morning in the room, and the breakfast room had a long conference table where all the students could be around it, the architectural students,
mm-hmm.
and I sat right at the corner of the table, and Mr. Wright sat right next to me. And we had chatted briefly in the theater, but this was a little closer contact, more personalized somehow. And so I was a little intimidated by all
that. Oh, I'm sure you were.
I was just young. And I forgot to open my napkin when we were going to eat. But he graciously said, "Aren't these lovely napkins?" You know. So then I opened mine up, and it flopped way over my lap, you know. And I said, "They're beautiful linen, but my goodness, they're man size," you know. And so he took his big napkin and opened it up, put one corner in his collar, the two corners out to the sides, and the one corner in his lap, and functional. That's all I could think of afterward. I was just sort of embarrassed at the time. But he was easy to be with because he's basically a lecturer. And he does a lot of lecturing when you're eating with him. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't expect much input from the fellas.
Oh, no kidding. Almost like a teacher.
Yeah. So he uses those times for teaching.
Okay.
And he's interested in all, he was interested in all kinds of things, world affairs. And being Earl was a conscientious objector, he touched on that subject too. And our very good friend was a student there. And he was a conscientious objector, so Wright maybe had some conversations with him.
His name was what?
Howard Tembrink.
Okay.
And his wife Ruth.
You visited them naturally while you were there?
Oh yeah, they showed us around the grounds and took us in where the architects' areas were. Each architect had their own little bedroom area where they could construct furniture as they wanted it. Mm-hmm. And then he took us where the huge loom was that they were making a beautiful rug on with all geometric patterns in it.
He did his houses complete, didn't he? I mean, he did furniture
everything.
And draperies and everything.
That's right. And everything was so unique, you know, and lovely.
You were there for how long?
Let's see, I think we left the Monday morning. We arrived Saturday evening. But Sunday night is worth talking about because
okay.
There we met in the living room. And Mr. Wright's wife came, and that was unusual for her to be out when the guests were around.
This was in his living room?
His living room. Mm-hmm. And they had overstuffed furniture there, with the exception of some built-in stuff by the fireplace. But that might have been her desire, you know, that he was accommodating, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't get acquainted with her, but Aaron Green knew that she liked praline candy, so we brought some of that when we came. And dinner was just served on these little TV tables. And after that was cleared away, by the way, the students do all the prep work, everything. They're taught all the domestic duties and so that they have a genuine feel for everything that goes on in the home. And
it's a fantastic idea.
Yeah.
Because so many times today, houses are designed without thinking of what people have to do in a house.
Yeah. And then after the food was taken away, there was a program. That's why we wore our formals, because it was a formal evening. And a group of the students had prepared a quartet number. And he had a beautiful grand piano in his living room. And then after that, his daughter played a couple selections on her harp, which was fantastic. And
how old was his daughter? Was she older? Late teens?
I really didn't get to know her well. I think she was older than I, but okay. Just how much older, I don't know. And then after that, one of the student architects had just come back from Alaska. Had some gorgeous, gorgeous slides. Every one of them was, I just thought of them as Christmas cards every month. Because they were, it's such beautiful country up there.
He really treated you like royalty when you were there.
Yeah, he really did. And it was a fantastic weekend.
Now you
and shortly after that, I was going to join my husband in a mental hospital. You can imagine the contrast.
Yes, yeah.
It's a good thing I had the experience of roughing it in the farmhouse.
Now, the hospital that your husband worked in as a conscientious objector was where?
There were a lot of conscientious objectors there because other people were looking for employment that paid a lot of money during the war.
Yeah.
And so they had practically no care in the hospitals. They were so vital there, I don't think. When I worked, I was in charge of 100 patients where there was supposed to be, with no background for it, 100 patients on the women's semi-violent, untidy ward.
Oh, Lord.
And I was alone with them so much, and there was supposed to be one attendant for every 8 patients on
where
that
was
ward.
This now?
That was in Connecticut.
Norwich,
Connecticut.
Okay.
Now, there were some other people. There was a nurse on the floor, but very often I was alone. And that particular ward was beyond me. I couldn't tolerate it very long. I don't know whether it was 2 weeks or 2 months, and I had to ask for a change.
No, your husband was working with another ward at the same time?
He was on the men's most violent ward.
Oh, Lordy.
And he worked those wards there and in Ohio for 4 years.
Did you go to Ohio, too, with him?
No. I became pregnant when I was in Connecticut, and the last stages of pregnancy, I went back to my home.
This was which child?
David.
Okay. When you say you went home, you went came
to
back to the co-op.
Parents.
To your parents.
Home,
okay.
Yeah. And then after David was 6 months old, Earl was able to transfer to the hospital in Ohio, and he had met a very fine couple there, who were also COs, and he was a civil engineer, and had done all kinds of great work.
Do you remember his name?
Oh yeah, Carl Schirmer.
Okay.
And we lived with them then for better than 2 years.
In Ohio.
In Ohio.
Okay.
And they became very dear friends. They're still my dear friends. And he became the head of the civil engineering department at Ohio University later.
Okay.
And but there were a lot of high caliber people in the CO group. And I really felt privileged to be with them. And
in the meantime,
but they had strong convictions too. Like back at the co-op, when they joined the co-op, they had strong convictions that they wanted to help each other build homes, and because they had the 3 month layoff in the summer, it made sense to use that wisely.
Did you keep in contact with the people here while you were away?
Yeah, in fact. At Christmas time, I remember they sent us a box of food because the food was so bad in those days. And I remember my mother-in-law sent us canned meat, and oh my goodness, you just didn't get meat, you know, especially in an institution.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, then when I came back, when I was with my mother, there were several families living in the farmhouse, and they bought a baby buggy and loaded it with baby things for me.
Isn't that nice?
They had a shower for me. Yeah, I really appreciated that.
So building still hadn't progressed that much. There still weren't that many houses while you were
that's
gone.
That's right. Well, Wright's house became a real problem during the war because they couldn't get any materials, and the fellows were all being drafted.
Or were working long hours.
Or were working long hours. And It was just not a very constructive period, that's for sure. And but windows and piping and for instance, we were supposed to have a sunken garden outside. The walls were the exterior walls were built up within forms, and then they graded the ground up to the window level, which was probably about 4 feet up.
Almost like one of these earth-sheltered homes they talk about today.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Big overhang.
And then it had, big overhang and massive pillars at the entrance. And I would love to have seen what that could have been, you know. It was primarily a flat roof talus. A couple layers to the roofing, though. And
but it was never finished.
It was never finished. The rains came and the winds blew and knocked the house down, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Brzezinski, I understand, salvaged a lot of the wood in the roofing for the construction of his house. And I don't know whether Fred Hiller's house was the first that was constructed. Fred didn't try to incorporate much of Wright's ideas. In fact, I don't know what in his house could be accredited to Wright's ideas. But Brzezinski did, and he put in floor heating in pipes and big expanses of window.
That was a novel idea for them.
And it was a tri-level house.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a good-sized family, and they had a basement area, you know, and adequate space for their family, and a shelter. What do they call it?
Carport.
Carport. Yeah.
Okay. That house is which one?
It's at the corner of Wright and Tawas now.
Okay.
And that had newspaper coverage. Perhaps I can get you a picture of that.
Okay.
And but when the Wright House was being built, we really had newspaper coverage too.
Did you have a lot of people?
Oh, it was a swarms of people came out, but they were interested in low cost housing, you know. And if they knew Wright's name, you know that. I don't know how many of the people were architectural engineers that came out. But I remember sitting there with the plans spread out so everybody could see what it was and explaining what was going to be happening.
It was going to be a large house, wasn't it?
Well, it was only for Mr. Worth and his wife. So there were only the two residents, and they were chosen to be the first to build because of their age. And also, they were going to turn the house over to the co-op when they died.
I see.
And, but of course they had to make other plans then.
You don't remember which year they started the Wright House, do you? By any chance? You must have still been there. You weren't with your husband yet.
We moved into the farmhouse in 1942.
Okay.
And Wright wasn't on the scene maybe till the end of that year, I guess.
Okay. Earl went into the Army.
Earl was drafted.
Or into co-op, conscientious objector.
Yeah. He was drafted in about August, I think.
Okay.
Of 1942.
So they did. They must have started building the house before you left, because you saw the people coming and all.
Oh yeah, before I left.
Yeah.
They were going at it good.
Okay.
But there was no roof on.
Okay. Now you came back when Earl came back. Do you remember what year that was?
What was that? 45.
45, 46, and then you started to build your house.
Oh no, we didn't. We didn't start right away.
Oh okay.
Oh my goodness, what all didn't he do during that time? He had so many skills. I know that he was busy all the time helping somebody, doing something. And there were still roads to be put in, water lines to be put in, and they dug the second well, a water well.
Because there was nothing out here.
No.
Nothing.
So to accommodate Brzezinski's house, they had to dig the well. And at that time, they just dug with shovel. The whole line was dug by shovel. And they tried to hook up. Well, Hiller's house had to be hooked up too. So there was a lot of hand shoveling. And I remember the little children, my kids in particular, we got sand buckets for them and little shovels, and they were out there doing their bit.
You know? You say cooperative, everyone cooperated.
Yeah, and we used to have good times together too. The potlucks were real fun, and we'd sing around the campfire, and the hoot owls would hoot. You know, one of my friends from the city came out and asked me, "How can you stand that hooting?" You know, but it was nice, you know, country.
You had animals? Did you have farm animals, though?
Eventually, we had quite a few. We experimented with quite a few. Our boys really learned to do their chores by feeding chickens and rabbits and ducks and geese, and in their turn, we tried a little bit of everything. We even tried to raise pigs with the skim milk that Twin Pines was just dumping, you know, that return milk. And then we had a cow that was fenced in by an electric fence and was totally oblivious to the poke it got if it got one at all. and wandered out on John R. one day and out through the ditches and the mud and everything, chasing that poor old cow. So that was the end of our cow experience. And the Van Hellas lived in the farmhouse at that time, and they had a horse. And the Van Hellas had a goat that they were milking, and they raised a lot of chickens. They had their own eggs. And I got to take this hat. And
you see, Errol had
the others didn't go in for any of the wildlife, farm life.
You said Errol had a lot of skills. He was a very socially conscious person, wasn't he?
Yeah.
In addition to just this cooperative idea.
I think it probably started when he was 14, when his father died. And there was no welfare system, so he realized the importance of the community, you know, to the welfare of their family. He was the eldest of four.
He was the man of the house.
He was the man of the house. And it was a very poor house, and he still remembered it with embarrassment because it was so... they were quite well off before his father died, but it was during the Depression that the everything was sold for peanuts, so they hardly had money to buy this parsonage, and it had been built 100 years before, so it had just had simple light fixtures in the center of the room, just one light, you know, and the plaster was going to pot. And so he learned to do wiring in that house, and eventually he put in, it wasn't until after we were married that he installed the water pipes from
plumbing.
The well and interior plumbing. Hmm. And he also put a basement under the house after it was standing there, you know. And so he became confident through the years just by, as a child, picking up parts for the bicycle. He was so proud that he got one bicycle together with mm-hmm. stray parts. And but then when he worked for Twin Pines, there he was, he signed in for maintenance work. And he really got a lot of licenses during that time to do all kinds of work. And we're now in factories, every man just sticks to his own skill. It's hard to find a well-rounded maintenance man. Mm-hmm. So when Twin Pines folded, he worked there for 25 years, he was employed by Park Davis, and they needed a foreman at Park Davis.
My dad worked for Park Davis, too. Yeah.
In Rochester?
No, he worked down in Jefferson. He worked at Rochester before he retired.
I see, uh-huh. Well, your dad might have known my husband.
Very possible, yeah.
Earl was the afternoon foreman.
Okay.
And And by that time, he had licenses in refrigeration, boiler operating, welding, you know, I don't know what they call all these licenses, but he could do electrical and plumbing. And
he was really interested in workers' rights, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. When I first met him, we were working at Johnson Milk Company, and the working conditions there were so bad for the men. It was fine for the women, but the men were treated shabbily. And they couldn't count on their days off. There was no overtime pay, and they were expected to work long, hard hours.
Carry heavy loads.
Carry heavy loads to the point where one man dropped dead when he was bringing in, I think it was 4 cases he was expected to carry full of milk. And Mr. Johnson had no heart for that condition at all. And so there were 3 men that decided they wanted to form a union. Earl was one of them. And Johnson immediately fired them when he found out. But he was ready to take a gun to them. He was threatening with a gun. You know, it was just... It was a serious situation for them. And eventually he signed up the whole plant in another union.
Really? You're kidding? Oh, no kidding.
And I was working in the office at the time, and I didn't particularly feel any need for joining the union, you know, because we were getting along fine in the office. Anyway, when he found out that I was going with seeing Earl,
okay.
That Earl was coming to my house, when he found out where I lived, then he started cruising in the neighborhood.
This is Mr. Johnson.
No, this is Earl.
Oh, okay.
Because he had time off when he was fired, you know.
Okay.
And one of the milkmen knew which depot I went to, and so he just hung around there until I came out. I was so surprised to see him, but it was company policy not for the girls not to mingle with the plant men. So I told him, well, I can't be seeing you, you know. And then he wanted so much to be with me. And so I said, well, you can come to church with me. He can't object to that. And so for a while we went to church together. But it wasn't long, and that wasn't enough. So we got married. I guess it was about a year and a half after. And we had 48 years of good marriage before he died.
That's great.
And raised our 3 sons and had 5 grandchildren. So we had a good life all that time. And no. Also, we built our house without borrowing money.
And he completely designed your house, didn't he?
Well, it was mostly my design.
Oh, okay.
And he was reticent about starting. Because he had this idea that he wanted a sandwich-type concrete wall with insulation in between the 2 layers. And it was a solid insulation. So he probably had to have time to organize his own thoughts.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And how he was going to install the windows and all the reinforcement rod that had to go in the concrete.
It's poured.
And then for the electrical, he had to have tubing, you know, in the concrete. So there was a lot of forethought that had to go into it. And when I got the basic layout in mind, we wanted to be able to move in at the earliest possible time. So basically, we just were interested in getting the outer walls, protecting us, and the roof over our head.
Did you put any of Frank Lloyd Wright designs in your house? Things that are similar to things that he might have done?
We tried to capture the spaciousness in our, okay. our living area is all along the south side of the house because the sun makes a big difference to me having light in
it. You can see it from 13 Mile. The big picture window is what, your living room?
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, we didn't have as much picture window as some of them later had. But... it was a big job for Earl to mount that by himself. And that was one thing that really scared the wits out of him. And but we do have nice overhanging eaves, and we do have that openness between the kitchen and the living area.
How about the ceilings?
And the cathedral ceilings give more spaciousness to the room.
Okay.
And also that made the construction simpler. And basically, the disadvantage with our house is that it has a central wall, a central hall, going the length of the house.
Mm-hmm.
But it gives access to the bedrooms to the north and the bathroom, and then to the south is, we have our living area.
How many bedrooms?
We were going to have four, so we put in four doors, but they turned out to be so small we just made three out of it.
Okay.
When we saw how... I think we've just become accustomed to spaciousness. And, you know, it just didn't make sense to cut it up anymore. But those walls, at first, we had no partitions for that, see. We used furniture to separate the rooms, we had an upright piano that separated the living room from our bedroom, and then the dresser separated our bedroom from the boys' area. The only room that was finished off was the bathroom, as far as the wallboard.
Now, how many children did you have at this time?
Three.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process, they were very interested in what was going on.
And what year was this?
They had a lot of exposure to their father's work. David was born in 43, and Hugh was born in 48. And Hugh was about, I think he was about 3 years old when...
About 1950, 51.
We didn't move in until 53, so
okay.
The building process probably started about 51 or 52.
Okay.
And Earl dug his own basement with a co-op tractor.
That was a job, too.
Sure.
Poured, the whole house is poured, concrete.
Yeah. The basement level, of course, they poured the concrete on the basement level with the mixers, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But on the upper level, that had to be poured by hand, and we had our own cement mixer because it was a slow process. We had to do it slow, and I remember mixing that stuff myself, you know. And I had a constructive part all through the years. But we saw progress all the time. Every week there was something new that had happened. And when I think of people just paying off debts, I feel so sorry for them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I really do. And they want their houses so fully furnished and go into debt for it, you know. Well, when we moved into our house, we were debt-free, so we took a nice vacation out to visit my parents out on the West Coast. We had a new car and no debt.
Oh, is that terrific.
So we were blessed, there's no question about it. And Earl had good health and strength, and the children were healthy, and so was I. And, you know, when you're young, things are possible that aren't old possible in your old age.
When did you become the bookkeeper for the co-op?
That was after the war. And when the Wright house failed, there were when Wright came in, there were some members who dropped out,
mm-hmm.
and they started paying them off. When Wright project failed, there were some members who dropped out, and so we were kind of at a bare bones state then. And I don't know just how we survived, but anyway, the one who had been the head bookkeeper then pulled out.
Do you remember the name?
Well, then it was Mrs. Smith.
Okay.
But they were living in the farmhouse at the time.
Okay.
And they pulled out their equity in a rather disreputable way because it was theirs, but we were spacing the payment, so everybody was being repaid something, you know, all the time. And
Earl was on the board at the same time or not?
Not at that time, no.
Okay.
In fact, the first time I worked on the books, they'd been turned over to Mr. Van Hella. because the Smiths had moved out. And he wasn't a bookkeeper, and a businessman, but not a bookkeeper. And so they asked me if I would audit the books. And I audited them at my mother's house. I was still there.
Mm-hmm.
But then when Earl came back, then I became the bookkeeper. In fact, it might have been before that.
Did you do this at Johnson's Milk? Is that how you got...
I did, yeah.
I see.
Bookkeeping was my favorite subject.
Oh, I see. Okay.
And I've done bookkeeping for nonprofit organizations at two different churches, one Christ Church Cranbrook, and I've really liked working there.
Mm-hmm.
And then I worked for a credit union, but my job at Johnson Milk Company gave me confidence. But I knew I was a good bookkeeper when I hired in there, but I wanted to work in the store. But in no time at all, he had me in the office. So anyway, I did have a background, but when the co-op started, they had a very capable accountant by the name of Bill Duran.
Okay.
And his bookkeeping was beautiful to look at.
They actually had an accountant.
And, yeah. Well, he was a member.
Okay.
And
did he build a house?
So no, he never did build a house. When Wright came on the scene, he dropped out.
Oh, no kidding.
And that's when Elisha Smith took over. And she was capable, too. And but there were a lot of funds going. You know, if you wanted to put your... there was a kind of a basic guideline for the equipment fund. You know, if we wanted to buy the tractor, they had to contribute to the equipment fund. But it was added to their equity.
Did you talk about this at meetings? Did you get together and say, we need a tractor, got to get some money, everybody's portion will be?
The road was one of the original things that they felt they needed to put in.
Oh, okay.
And one of the men worked at a factory, and a foundry, and the slag that was thrown out normally became the base for our road. And it's still a good, solid area, and 50 years later, and it's never been paved since then. So, but the city did put a coating on it that really lasted long, but we didn't have too heavy a traffic going over either.
Mm-hmm.
And right now there's 22 homes, and right now we are no longer an incorporated co-op.
When did it break up?
Let's see. We realized that we had to break up when...
break up.
The incorporation, you mean?
Yeah.
The liquidation procedure.
Right.
I don't know the exact date, but it's quite a few years ago now.
Okay.
And... But the taxes got prohibitive for some of the people to keep up with, you know.
For this whole big area.
And we were paying the taxes on all the unsold acreages besides our own personal property.
You had a total of 120 acres.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so it became evident that we should sell some of it anyway. And then... When the college was looking for property,
Oakland County.
The Oakland Community College was really looking for property, and we thought we'd love to have a college by us. And when they purchased it, it was one outright sale. And in the meantime, then our attorney drew up papers transferring all the. We formed what was a water trusteeship because we were going to continue to use the water system. And so they elected a group of men to be trustees for the water.
Okay.
And then everything was transferred to them. And it took an act of trust and faith, you know, for everybody to do that.
You don't remember the original men on that board, do you?
I can get that name for you, but I His name escapes me.
The attorney?
And he was a great attorney.
But how about the men on the original water board? Do you remember
them? Oh, yeah. That Earl was the main one because he had the skills to maintain the well.
Okay.
And I think John Brzezinski was one. And
okay.
Probably Hiller.
Fred Hiller?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
So, it and then I kept the books for the water. And so when we liquidated, part of the $100 equity was transferred to the trustees and from each member. And then the balance was distributed among the whole membership. And it seemed like a windfall to us, and it seemed like such a relief to get that done. We'd had the property appraised, but shortly after that, when it was rezoned for, you know, light industry, the price skyrocketed where the city wouldn't have given us that zoning. You know, they have to make it political. So anyway,
Did you have trouble figuring out your boundaries when you did this? Did this land have to be divided in some way?
We had a lot of problems with the surveyors. We had five professional surveyors in various times,
mm-hmm.
and they all came up with different answers. And when the Madison Heights did it, it was worse than ever. But see, what the original property deed called for was a quarter acre and a half acre. And a quarter section and a half section. And so it was three quarters section, really. And it didn't actually have a meets and bounds description, you know, the angles and all that stuff
mm-hmm.
on it. And so this whole mile square here was relatively unplatted, you know. And so each time they seem to start off from a different point and get a different answer. So twice our deed was changed. Once just to accommodate our septic field in the back, and the next time everything was moved forward. How was that? Anyway, we were left without the back area, so they added a few feet to us on the back. And then this last time they had to add a few feet on the front because mm-hmm. they had crowded into our driveway.
Now your holdings probably weren't getting any bigger, were they?
No.
Little by little they were eking the pieces away.
Yeah, it was just the weirdness of the surveys.
Mm-hmm.
It was really disgusting. So when that last survey was done, I said, now how can we be sure that these are going to be permanent? Because that constant juggling was nerve-wracking.
Is that when you got individual deeds?
Oh, no, we had deeds before that.
Okay.
And everybody knew where their lot line should be. Well, when the assessor's plat came, that was supposed to describe each
parcel.
And it was they were just out lot so-and-so, or rather lot so-and-so, ours is lot 18. And but the strange thing was that on the west side of Tawas, the property's descriptions moved back. On the east side of Tawas, they moved forward. And not just a little bit, but considerable. And we were accustomed to having a foot or two, you know, as variance. But anyway, so I demanded, how are we going to know that this is going to be permanent? And then he said, we'll put down steel markers, steel monuments. And so I know where my steel monument is. and you have to find it with one of those metal detectors, but it's there. And so anyway, that part I think is over the hump. And it encroached on our property much more than I anticipated, but
mm-hmm.
in the front, on the roadside.
Did you have a hand when the incorporation was broken up? Did you have a hand in setting up the deeds or the...
I was bookkeeper at that time.
Okay.
And there was such a massive amount of deeds that it was done by the attorney
okay.
in his office.
Okay.
And because they, let's see, they didn't have to turn over their personal deeds, though.
Okay.
But there were a lot of legal documents.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had this agreement how the water situation was to be handled. And there were things about that that we should have changed because it called for monthly billing, and if we had billed them monthly, it would have been 50 cents, you know, for all of everybody. So most of the time, it would run $25 a year.
And you're still using the same well, aren't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, we just have the electric expense.
Water's still good?
Constant. Yeah, the water hasn't changed. And it's tested regularly every month for pollutants. And then for other things, it's tested by the state occasionally. And so far, we've been doing fine.
Do you call someone out to maintain the pump on a regular basis? Or the
no, our men had the ability to do that.
Okay.
But it's gotten to the point now where we might have to call outside help.
Mm-hmm.
And if the submerged pump, we bought a standby submerged pump in case that goes, because that's been down for quite a few years, but it's still functioning beautifully, so we're not about to pull it up.
City wanted to put water in, right?
Yeah. We're the only area in Madison Heights that doesn't have sewer and water, but because they're acre sites, the septic fields are adequate. And some of the houses are having some drainage problems when the frost is in the ground and in the spring, you know. And so the one family that wanted to build would turn down, but they had it tested at the wrong time, you know. And so anyway, I've learned so much through this whole experience and relations with people.
What was the family life like in the co-op?
It
must have been a good place to live.
Yeah, it was. And we had quite a few Catholic families, and their children went to the Catholic school, but the others went to Lamphere on the corner. And so they would walk together and fool around the creek together, and, you know. And we had a big sandbox by the farmhouse when we lived there. That was a joy and a torment because all the kids would gather there, you know, and we soon got away from cheap toys for our kids. We had the tractors and the trucks that were good heavy duty ones, you know, and the children, I think they had some really valuable experiences because the adults had to get along and the children had to get along, and we mingled so much in the potlucks and everything, so we all knew each other, and we knew each other's children, and so it was a safe and secure area for them to be in, no matter where they went.
You would say the cooperative idea was worked then.
Oh, I value those years very much. I really do. I'd like to see more of that kind of going on. Now, as people moved out, there was less and less, and when we dissolved the corporation, we had no need for meetings, and the water didn't give us that much problem. And with new people, then they hardly knew what the water system was about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they don't have the interest that the old-timers have. And it bothers me that when I walk down the street, I don't know who's living in that house. I know that we've got their name on the water register, but
you don't know who they are?
No, I don't know them personally.
You had plans for an area.
On the other hand, it's a friendly community. I can get acquainted.
Still?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I can approach people and make myself acquainted with them.
Do you still feel as if you're in the country? Or not as much?
Yeah. I appreciate the city that's grown up around us and the facilities we have so readily available, you know. But I think of the oasis we're living in. It's really, with everyone having that much land around them, it's just a fresh air spot.
Very uncommon, tonight. Yeah.
And I just think, gee, that's the way people ought to live. You know, this compact city life is not according to right.
You even had plans for another area off of 13 Mile, didn't you? nursery.
The park area was supposed to have a co-op gas station, a co-op grocery store, and a co-op nursery.
That never came about, though.
No. When Wright was out, the plans were out. And after the war, they had intended to help each other build houses. After the war, the families were more demanding, and family life was. And people had pretty much crystallized their own plans for their own house, and a lot of them had money to go ahead on their own. Some of them hired a lot of the labor on their house and just did a little bit themselves. So it was a totally different picture. But
still cooperative.
There was still a good community feeling. And we would have get-togethers on holidays and stuff. But that has sort of petered out, too, with all the influx of new ones.
What was this area out here
now,
like?
A lot of the homes are being bought up by single people.
No, not as many children.
I don't know if it's being manipulated by the realtors or not, you know, because they still would like to see it turn to sewer and water, you know. And whether the state has any input there, but I know that when the state inspector Mr. Lanier was a very lovely man, and he used to come to my house to get the state sample of water. And but he wanted to know how many residents there were, and he was concerned because we don't meet the state code for our well, but under the grandfather clause, we're entitled to keep it.
Because you're already there.
Yeah. And it's functioning well, and there's no real cause for alarm, you know.
You had the opportunity to be developed not too long ago, right? Someone wanted to develop that area, or you could have sold the whole area?
Yeah, and we got together as a group, and they talked it over to a considerable extent.
Mm-hmm.
And there were quite a few who were kind of eager to move at this point, you know, up in years, and mm-hmm. and health failing and stuff. And the homes, some of them were too big for the, with the family gone and so on.
Because they are large homes.
And so that everybody could sort of rationalize moving, and then if they got a good price for it, you know, then
make it even better.
They were willing. But to find anything comparable, that was a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And but anyway, they did. Agree that for the good of the city, it might be, well, we couldn't stop the city from growing. And there are some lots that are inaccessible for building now. They won't allow them to put septic fields on it. And so these people can't build on their lots. There's two, I think. And so for concern for them, too, you know, we had to think about everybody. And they drew up an agreement that everyone would be compensated first for double the assessed valuation, and then everything else would be divided on a footage basis.
Footage of the house?
Footage of each property.
Okay.
And Nazarene Church was going to sell out.
Oh, you're kidding!
And that new house that on 13
by the water park.
Yeah, that isn't a member even. They were thinking of selling.
So that would have been quite a large parcel.
Yeah, and also when the assessor's plat was drafted, we were offering the city 2 acres for doing the work on the plan, and it was for their benefit primarily, so that they could assess us, you know. And in the process, they gerrymandered around like you wouldn't believe. and then they wanted 4 acres, so they had to have 4 acres big enough for a football field. So 4 acres of city property were then going to be involved in this sale also. Mm-hmm. So the city had an interest. And one woman wouldn't sign the agreement because she didn't have a house and she felt the whole total amount should be divided equally. I could make some private comments on that. I don't want it on record. But
okay. So when you have when you run into the opportunity where you could sell, you all agreed. Mm-hmm. You had one person that was a stumbling block. Mm-hmm. So it didn't go through this time.
So it didn't go through.
You're not anxious to have it go through, obviously. Because you like living there.
I love living there.
Yeah. And quite a few of the people do.
And even in the winter, you know, the snow sparkles for such vast areas around you, you know. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, when the trees get the snow built up on them, they're so pretty, and the ice formations, you see such a vast amount of it, you know. It's really spectacular. And then in the spring, when everything starts to blossom out, it's, our fruit trees all have different colored blossoms, you know.
Yeah, you've got quite an orchard.
Yeah, we do. There's
grapes?
I think there's 7 different kinds of apples and 5 kinds of pears and 15 varieties of grapes. And we have black raspberries. And
all bearing fruit.
And we had a lot of red raspberries, but they're gone now. And the blueberries aren't doing so well. But we had a sizable area for a garden, and I'm not too sure what's going to happen with that now with my husband not on the scene. If I could find a rototiller, that would be easy for me to do.
Your house looks very nice.
Did you ride by it again?
Yes. Very nice.
I was so pleased with that freshness of the paint.
It looks very good. Yeah. The blue is striking.
Yeah. And that grapevine is from Earl's Vines.
See, I think the green dated it a little bit, but the blue is really striking. You even put a new light on, a brass light.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks good.
Yeah, I like it. It was a real uplift to me to get that done. And my son helped me on the high part of the house.
Well, you indicated that some of the people had let their property go a little bit because they were under the impression it was going to be sold, too.
Yeah, and it was supposed to go down to the ground, you know. Mm-hmm. That would have been a traumatic time for me.
Now, when I went through the other day, everything looked very nice.
Yeah.
People must have been doing, they must have been working on their houses recently because they all look very nice, really.
Yeah. Yeah, this, you know, they were just holding back. What's the point in investing thousands of dollars if you're, if it's going to be knocked down?
You told me about, we've talked about all the different types of people that lived in the co-op subdivision and how it was a good place to live. Tell me something about the children. How did some of the children wind up that lived there?
Oh, yeah. There was a group called Quest. They wanted to cooperate to a fuller extent than the bulk of the people did, in that they wanted their children to have the same care, you know, that, and they wanted to do more things together. They all went to the same church, mm-hmm. and which was Central Methodist Church downtown, and had an excellent minister there, renowned. I've forgotten his name now, but anyway. the McClanahans kind of spearheaded the Quest group. His interest was keen in co-ops, and he's continued to follow the credit union co-ops through the years. And since they moved from here, they've gone to the Appalachia area and started co-ops there, you know, and really brought those poor people up. And but in the process too, they've been in many states.
You were part of a movement that was actually starting up right about then.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay. Co-op gas stations and credit unions.
Yeah. And Fred Thornthwaite, who started our co-op, is the one who started the senior citizen building on Edwards Avenue.
Oh, no kidding.
And he was the manager for that for quite a while. quite a while. And he was the one that took all the government financing headache, you know, and all mm-hmm. that stuff. And got the people co-op minded. And so he was a good organizer. I don't know just what his health might be, but he was considerably older than I was. And he's an uncle to young Fred Hiller, who's, well, he was a brother to Faith Hiller.
Okay.
And had a lovely mother. And but getting back to Quest, the program they had at the Methodist Church down there was fantastic for character development. That was a strong thrust. In fact, they were trying to develop a character education program that would be suited for the public schools.
Oh, I see.
And it was very scientifically done. The people who participated in had to examine the work that was the studies that were ahead, tell how their children related to that theme, and then at the end to make a comparative study at the end of a quarter, and then they found out which lessons were effective and doing something, and where the family responded and the children responded. And so it was hard work for the teacher, it was hard work for the parents.
And many of you were involved in that, right?
I was involved in it for a while, but I was alone with my children so much, and Earl had to work Sundays, and taking them down there was just overwhelming to me. They were, Hugh was just a toddler at the time, not even potty broken, so it was too much of a chore for me. But
as a whole, though, the children from your whole area came up very well.
But the Quest children now, okay. All five of them are, one's a brain surgeon, another is a doctor, a holistic doctor. Another one operates the father's steel business, the grandfather's steel business in Pennsylvania. They're all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And another one is on the West Coast doing ecological study in the Seattle area. And boy, that place, I was out there and I can't get over the change that's happened there since the World's Fair was there. So they've stripped down so, people saw the greatness of that area. And there's just been such a massive influx and the houses are becoming bumper to bumper, you know, all these condos and apartments, and it's a totally different picture. And the trees are disappearing. The climate is really changing.
Mm-hmm.
When my mother moved there, that was back in the early 40s, just right after I got married. And my father retired and they moved out there. And the rainfall then, they called it rain, but it was just a beautiful mist. You could walk out in it and it was just refreshing. And when it snowed, they didn't have any salt on the roads. They didn't have any road grading equipment. And there's lots of mountainous areas, you know. But they just closed down for a day. By that time, it would have disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Now they have heavy snowfalls and heavy rains. And you may be heard about that one lake that where the water rose so much, the floating bridge was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that was a major thoroughfare, you know. And so it's definitely a climatic change that the world has to be aware of.
Mm-hmm. People overdoing and overpopulating.
Yeah.
And
but it was the transition started to happen when they had the World's Fair there and people got exposed to it, you know. And but I have two brothers that live out in that area, and I've just visited last year. I was dumbfounded.
You told me a story the other day that I think sums up the cooperative spirit.
Before we get off of ecology,
okay.
I often think of the good farmland that was here.
Mm-hmm.
And it troubles me that the dense cities are built on good land. And we have so much submarginal land that why can't they be out there, you know?
Yeah, it is something, isn't it?
But leave the farm country so we've got food for the table eventually, you know?
And farmers are actually going out of business now because they're not making enough money to keep going, selling off their land bit by bit. That's a shame.
I don't know. I think the national planning for conserving the land, they're very concerned about wetland right now, and they're legally they're doing things about that.
And that's a good thing.
And yeah, it preserves some of the wildlife. Mm-hmm. But whether that can be converted to farmland later, I don't know. Maybe it can. But anyway. Anyway, we're definitely in changing times. Now, getting back to the children, there were not only were the McClanahan children great, but the there was one young man that is now a chaplain in a prison.
Okay.
And one is a Catholic priest.
Okay.
And one is a Methodist minister. And one is a school teacher. And
your boys.
No, the his friend, and my son's one's a metallurgical engineer, and one is very much into auto mechanics. From the time he was in high school, he was working on the school buses. Mm-hmm. That's what kept him in school. He didn't want to continue school, but they let him work on the school buses, but he was very adept at that kind of stuff, and David is in plumbing. And has built his own home two times now. And his first home was one that was moved from to make way for the expressway when 696 was coming through. And he utilized one of those houses. My husband helped him dig a new basement and reestablish the house then.
Sounds to me like some of the values of the co-op were definitely transferred to the kids.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
It was a good place to live.
Yeah. And even those that went into the medical field, you know, the kids used to monkey with chemistry together, and I had chemistry stuff there that I knew nothing about, and it made me kind of leery, but they seemed to know what they were doing. But one time, I don't know if you heard about young Freddie Hiller, he built some kind of an explosive thing. Could have been really serious, but it was minor.
Now, you told me the other day.
And then also when the slag was on the road. Is that what you're thinking of?
Well, tell us that story, too.
When the slag was on laid down first, the kids, of course, were attracted to it, and they found it was hand-sized so they could throw it. when they were having a free-for-all, well, one slab hit David in the face, in the head, and he came into the house a bloody mess. But it was just a little 3-inch gap, but not even a 3-inch, about an inch and a half. Mm-hmm. But they had to take stitches in it to close it up. So that was. But there was very little of that hazardous kind of play.
Mm-hmm. Just good fun.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they had so much construction going on all the time, you know, and things to learn and bits of wood and stuff to play with, and you know, they saw the use of the materials. Now when a house goes up, it's pretty much forbidden territory for kids, but not when we were building.
You told me the other day about a gentleman that had a problem, and the people in the co-op got together to help him. Tell us about that, because that to me.
Yeah, it was indicative.
Embodies your cooperative spirit.
Yeah, because they were socially minded. You know, they wanted to do what they could to build up the nation, really, in their own little spot. You know, and this family in Detroit heard about the co-op somehow. I don't know who. The Jasper family, this was. And they lived in Detroit and in a rough area and had two children. And so we just thought we were doing them a great service to help them come and live in the farmhouse inexpensively and build
get out in the clean air and
get out in the and they were very happy at first. Then she started to get some grandiose ideas you wouldn't believe, totally unreasonable. And I think it caused their marriage to really go downhill. It was beyond what he could cope with, you know. And she was very difficult for us to get along with. She could have one friend very solidly at one time, and nobody else counted. Just that one buddy.
Mm-hmm.
And she sort of circulated to the whole co-op and became an intimate friend with each one in turn. And I remember when she took on me, you know, and she was pregnant at the time, and so I wanted to help her sew some of her own dresses to save money. And I helped her get going on it, and I loaned her my sewing machine. And she sewed those dresses and benefited in a lot of ways. But eventually I needed my sewing machine back. Man, it was, you know, I had my own mending pile. You'd think I had asked for the world. And that was the end of our friendship. So she was a hard person for even the adults to deal with. And she was actually cruel with her children sometimes. I don't even like to tell what she did. Mm-hmm. But it got to the point we couldn't stomach it anymore. Her little infant child, just learning to walk, was going to the car. And she was spanking it all along the way. And the toddler could hardly walk. And another time, I saw her throw her child across the room. Fortunately, it was a couch. I don't know if she was aware where she was throwing the kid, but she just had a wildness about her that we were really at our wit's end.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't seem like safe people to have in the community. And the provisions of the Constitution was such that we could, if people didn't pay their bills or they were undesirable, we could vote them out. We could pay them off and vote them out. And that was the one case that we did that in.
Mm-hmm.
But we did have to pay back a lot of people who wanted out, you know,
mm-hmm.
for one reason or another. And one was a man who wasn't suited for building his own house. And they didn't have the money to hire it done.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that caused a lot of marriage breakdown, a lot of trouble in their family. They just had a roof over their head, and that you know, that things just weren't going well. And so he became an alcoholic. And I got to know the family reasonably well because I took their little girl to Sunday school with me. So I had some contact with the family. But as time went on then, his wife was going to get a divorce from him. And his drunkenness, he had no money. And so he was drinking to the point that he had bleeding ulcers. And then we at the co-op saw that he got in the hospital and was cared for. And then when he was discharged, he came back, and when I called at his house, he was just sitting huddled in the kitchen with just the cook stove, the stove to heat the house, and no food. And it was really pathetic. So I wrote a letter. I knew the community didn't want that to continue. And it said that the children would be coming around with their wagon and bushel baskets to fill with food. And the cooperation was beautiful. And he was so grateful. And somebody else came and filled his oil tank. And then we contacted the wife, and she was on her way back. And the whole family got back together again, and things really reshaped. Now, just how it was all handled, I don't know, because I didn't know them that intimately.
This is what cooperation can do, though.
But, yeah, it can really transform them. Oh, I had the minister council with him.
Oh, my.
And when he told me that he'd been reading the Sunday school papers to his daughter, that encouraged me. Mm-hmm. And so the minister prayed with him, and he went got relocated in Hazel Park and went to a church right close to their home. So, you know, I was ready to shout hallelujah, you know. But then somebody else bought that house. And that's where the music teacher lives now, Yvonne Schella. And she's a very desirable neighbor.
Mrs. Naniga, this has been a thrill. This interview has been one of our best, and I want to thank you for coming out today to do this. We appreciate it. And the time is now 3:05.
Is it really?
Yes, it is. Thank you very much. The time has gone by so fast.
Yesterday and
well, thank you.
I shouldn't miss it.
Thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Okay.